Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves. And today, because it's like almost, it's the height of Irish summer, it's over 18 degrees and everybody's must be out at the beaches and covered in sun cream. So me and Martin are here doing a podcast. Isn't that right, Martin?
That's right, Tony.
Yeah, look, folks, you don't understand this. Martin has actually the only person who literally covers up as soon as he's like pure vampire. Like if you should see him now.
I do, yeah, I do. And I sparkle in the sunlight, Tony.
Look, just quick thing for you, bit of housekeeping. The new Built Different podcast is coming very soon. And if you are a patron, it's in your feed already. Joella and Benita are coming out with their own series of intersectional conversations. And you know what? I'm producing it, so of course I'm going to tell you it's great. But do check it out. It's called Built Different, and it will be in your podcast feeds from later next week. But if you're a patron, it's there already. Without further ado, we are delighted to be rejoined via Zoom by our friend in New York now, John Schwartz of The Intercept. John, how are you keeping?
You know, I'm great. I'm happy to say that I'm fully vaccinated. And it's a huge change to be living in a country that has a president now who is not actively trying to kill me. You know, he may passively kill me and he may actively kill other people. But just the fact that he's not actively trying to kill me is a big change.
That's actually, it must be a relief, is it, John? Like to see... there's two Americas still, absolutely, but the America overall, the vaccine program has been, it's been a success. It's been, you know, he's had some good wins, has Joe Biden.
You know, he has, like just, you know, like the basic fact that they're able to perform with just a normal level of competency and actually like get these vaccines out to, you know, over 100 million people is really something. Like we just kind of gotten used to having a government where they're like, well, you know, we can't really build a road, and that is different now, and it feels much better. Like I never knew that I would miss like just basic competency, even at you know, things that you might not want them to be doing. Like just the fact that they can say they're going to do something and then do it is an enormous relief that I didn't know that I would miss until it was gone.
Go ahead, Martin.
I was just going to say, does government by tweet not, you know, the absence of that not leave a vacuum in your life, John?
Like that is true. You know, it leaves me with, you know, I used to spend, you know, 16 waking hours consumed with anxiety. And so now I have a lot more free time. That's true.
John, just there's a couple of things I want to cover. Since the last time we spoke, I just referred to it, the two Americas. And, you know, there was this ridiculous phenomenon of really the culture wars on steroids. You know, Dr. Seuss is being cancelled and everything's being cancelled and they're coming for you and they're coming for you. And then we saw the situation with a young journalist called Emily Wilder, who you wrote about on The Intercept, and her situation as it pertains to actual, how do I put this, cancel culture, as opposed to what we would always say, it's not cancel culture, it's simply accountability. If listeners are unaware, do you want to give us like a quick summation of that, if you don't mind?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, I actually wrote something long ago about this general subject, which is that, you know, what we call cancel culture is largely just, you know, sort of just, you just call it groupthink, which exists in all, you know, human organizations. All groups of people are all prone to this, and they're all prone to punishing heretics. And the reality in the United States is that political correctness, cancel culture, or whatever you want to say, 90% of it has always come from the right in the U.S. And it's funny because now like both 90% of cancel culture and 90% of complaining about cancel culture comes from the right in America.
We're going to hit pause on the podcast for just a minute because, well, because we have to. These podcasts take time, effort, money, labor of love, yes, but unfortunately, love doesn't pay the bills. If you enjoy what the Tortoise Shack produces and be that any of the podcasts that we do, please consider going to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There's a range of options there. I mean, it starts from a couple of quid. But for 550, whatever it is, there's a euro amount in there. You get a ton of extra content. You'd have been at last night's Live Glow West, and you could be at tomorrow night's Live Write the Protest podcast, because that's where all of that stuff goes, plus our regular Sunday shows and all of the other things that people come along to and enjoy. Doesn't happen without you guys. And, you know, we are growing. We took the decision to keep growing the podcast as a network. And rightly or wrongly, we pushed our cards onto the table. And the only way it works is if you put your hands in your pocket. We could do with a lot more of you helping us, if I'm being perfectly honest. And if you are on patreon.com/tortoiseshack and you're listening to our podcast, you don't have to hear me ask for this, because the podcast come out without this little interruption. So isn't that a nice little sweetener?
That is the best feature of the whole lot, Tony. So patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thanks, folks. Let you go back to your podcast now.
It's funny because now like both 90% of cancel culture and 90% of complaining about cancel culture comes from the right in America. But this is a perfect example of this, is that, Emily Wilder, 22 years old. She recently graduated from Stanford. She had worked, I think, for a newspaper in Arizona for a period of time. And then she'd just gotten hired by the Associated Press and had worked for them for 17 days. And then they fired her after she had come under attack from this vast panoply of like right-wing organizations. I think the Stanford Republicans and even Tom Cotton, who you may know is a senator from Arkansas, had a
thoroughly this unpleasant man, shall we say.
Exactly. Like he has the charisma of like a lump of sod. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't think he's going to become president because he's so, because of his, just because of his personality, in the same way that I think Ted Cruz is probably not going to become president. Like they would like to emulate the sort of tweeting behavior of Donald Trump, but they're both so bad at it that they're never going to get anywhere. But anyway, she came under attack, like from this huge group of people, including a U.S. senator, and AP just immediately caved and fired her. And would not even explain exactly what it was that she'd done, except that she purportedly had violated their social media policy. And they wouldn't point to any specifics about this. But what really happened, obviously, is that she had been involved with various groups that had committed the crime of believing that Palestinians are human beings in college. I think she belonged to Jewish Voice for Peace. And so that, from the perspective of these groups, like, is the ultimate crime. And anyone who like espouses such heresy, must be crushed. And so they did. And it's really an ugly story. But what I wrote about is that it shouldn't surprise people, because AP, people probably know, I mean, it's not just an American, but an international news institution, has always been conservative.
Recently bombed by the Israeli military, by the way.
That's right. Like being conservative did not save them. That didn't mean that their building would not be blown up. But that, of course, is one of the most bizarre parts of this, that their building in Gaza was destroyed. It wasn't just their building, but it's the building where their offices were. And they had their building destroyed, their journalists almost killed. And then immediately afterwards, they're like, yes, we absolutely will fire this 22-year-old. We don't want, we could see, we've already been bombed once. Don't want it to happen any more times.
But I suppose it plays to, I know it was across the wires and the Fox News people were agitating, and as you've alluded to, but then I also quite worryingly saw for the first time, I don't know, we covered Gaza very extensively, John, almost with daily podcasts from on the ground by Hannah Salah, who was a journalist there who we've spoken to several times on the podcast, and we were covering it extensively, and we were noticing a mood change in the stuff coming out of the US. Everybody bar except actually President Biden, who stuck to the old both sides, Israel's right to defend itself, all of the old tropes came back. And even on his own side, you know, the condemnation from everybody on the left of him was that he absolutely was just empowering Netanyahu. And it looks like he has actually. It looks like we're going to push for another election, and his hand is only strengthened by this. I don't know if there's a question in that, but I can tell you that watching this young woman lose her job for expressing what I would believe to be a mainstream view just seems toxic for journalism.
It absolutely is. It's not anything new, in journalism in the United States. I mean, the fact that, like, it's amazing she got a job in the first place. You know what I mean? Like, in the past, she probably would not have been involved in the kind of activism that she was. Like, it really is a new era that there is a lot of ferment and activism on this issue on college campuses. So that's positive, just the fact that she was there and doing this. The fact that she had access to social media to express what, as you say, is a normal worldwide mainstream opinion. Like, that's also positive for America. Things really have changed. And in fact, you talked about Joe Biden talking about Israel having the right to defend itself. My entire life, whenever I've heard that, I've always been like, when is a journalist going to ask if Palestinians have the right to defend themselves? Doesn't that seem like an obvious,
but question if things, that's the subject? Have things changed that much, John, when she still loses her job?
Well, I have to tell you, like, I'm sorry to say that this nevertheless remains a big change, but it does. Like the fact that she lost her job and there's been an enormous outcry, not just in public, but among AP journalists. Like, I think over 100 journalists wrote a letter to their management saying, what on earth is going on here? There's been an outcry across the journalism profession. There's been an outcry all over the place. It's going to be a big problem, I guarantee you, for the incoming editor of the Washington Post, who left her job as the head editor of AP, even though she claims, she wasn't involved in any of the decision-making here. And that's probably true, because, she was on her way out anyway. But nonetheless, I don't think she's going to be able to escape saying something about it. So you might think it's incredible that a situation that doesn't look very good on its face is nonetheless the result of a huge positive change, but it is.
Can I move us?
Everything's on? Relative, is what I'm saying.
I get, and I look, we it's a topic I'm sure we'll probably discuss again, but I want to move us on because there's a lot. Okay, since the last time we spoke, let's try give a few quick things on the plus side. We've had Biden has successfully rolled out the vaccine. Biden has successfully implemented a stimulus package. Biden has brought back a sense of normalcy to international relations. There's talk of, re-entering the Iran nuclear deal in some sort of form or shape. The climate accords have signed back in. Some of these diplomatic norms have returned, but some of the things that he's failed to do. One particular was obviously his pledge on increasing the amount of migrants they'd allow. Definitely got very far down the road. And you also wrote a piece about a short history of Americans praising their own generosity, from the genocide of a Native American to Trump's child snatchers. I put it to you, John, that in the figures that we've seen, of President Biden, I know he has made more commitments to change it, but he's flip-flopped in the modern parlance. It doesn't seem that it's as welcoming as, and immigration remains a hot topic that even he's afraid to really address.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's one of those situations where Democrats are being screamed at constantly, and they're like, well, let's split the difference between our side and the people who think that we're secretly intergalactic space lizards. You know what I mean? Like, there really is no moderate middle position on this issue, and yet they're going to try to find it. Like, no matter what they do, the right in this country will go absolutely bonkers about it. So, unfortunately, that's the path that they're taking, and we'll see how it turns out.
I think that's, and again, the great replacement theory has now become mainstream. It was mentioned by some of the Fox News hosts as if it was some sort of, you know, watch out for it, guys. We're there won't be any white people left. But in terms of the piece that you wrote on the generosity, I'm fascinated. Look, first of all, do you want to just give a flavor to listeners of what you were talking about? Because it's a short piece and it's well worth. We'll plug it up. We'll have the link in the podcast. But it's well worth people throwing an eye over it, especially given the circumstances we see now in terms of America's place in the world.
Yeah, well, it's just this weird tick. It's not a tick of American psychology. I think it's kind of universal, as I will soon demonstrate. But whenever you hear powerful people talking about how generous they're being, you know, to some group, that means that group is absolutely having the crap beaten out of them. Like it's pretty much universally true. And you know, I thought about it because Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary was talking about their treatment of immigrant children and said, you know, this is one of the great acts of American generosity and charity, what we're doing for these unaccompanied kids. And so you don't need to know anything about the specifics. You just need to know that government officials are praising themselves for their generosity. And you're like, oh man, I hope those people watch out because they're really getting it now. And it goes back through all American history. Like, Andrew Jackson, when he gave his speech, it was in 1829. He was making the case for the Indian Removal Act. And he said, this was in an address to Congress, and he said, rightfully considered, the policy of the general government toward the red man is not only liberal, but generous. And of course, it was enacted the next year, 1830. It led to the Trail of Tears. People may know this was the uprooting of the Cherokee.
We're very aware of it. An Irishman led some of the more powerful, poignantly vicious and evil parts of it. Where a man who had left our shores. So we're very aware of the Trail of Tears in Ireland. We have a memorial actually to it in Galway, I believe, Martin.
Oh, that is interesting. I'm impressed that that's a history that Ireland recognizes. I mean,
it's recognized. It's known more on the left than it is in mainstream, but we recognize it. We absolutely do. Yep, we know our part.
And I didn't know that. I didn't know that. But I'll have to look up that guy and see how he was inspired to come over to America and
Biden
take charge.
Biden has backpedaled on a couple of things now since he got in. Student debt is one thing where he was expected to perform, and he's actually set the target now of reducing student debt by zero. So there's nothing much going to happen there. I mean, he's not winning any young votes over with those kind of actions.
Yes, he's being abundantly generous to the indebted students.
Yeah, he is abundantly generous.
So they can look back through history and see that it's the same thing happening again. You know, other examples are like in The Winning of the West, which is this book that Teddy Roosevelt wrote before he was president. He was saying, we've been more than just to the Indians. We have been abundantly generous.
I'm looking over my shoulder and I know Bury My Heart of Wounded Knee is just there, and it's, you know, you can read all the parts, but I'm always shocked about the manifest destiny nature of it and how we hear the echoes of it. In fact, we have it here in one of our own now tarnished said he was, you know, he used the phrase, unfortunately, many years ago. I've an echo, sorry. He was talking about his
destiny to become Taoiseach, to become the leader of the country. And it didn't matter where he was born.
Even though he was the son of a doctor from
had he been born in the poorest parts of Dublin, he'd still be the Taoiseach.
But when you don't understand it, can John, just in terms of the US's place, though, as it tries to reestablish itself. We were talking about Belarus this week. We were talking about what's gone on there. We were talking about people, and one of the journalists that we spoke to made the point that in a way, the US still needs the bogeyman, still needs Russia as the bogeyman, and Russia just simply isn't an economic force anymore. Is the struggle really the internal struggle within the US? Are we still just, because the vaccine thing has gone so well, the economy's doing all right, are we still really just papering over the cracks that it's going to be back to that madman in a few years' time running again, and we're going to have this polarization won't have healed at all?
It is certainly not headed in the right direction, let's say. I mean, I'm sorry to say this, but like there is certainly a non-zero possibility that Donald Trump will be president of the United States again. You know, there's a non-zero possibility that it's going to be someone who is even worse than Donald Trump. You know, someone who is not, you know, that doesn't possess his two main positive characteristics as president, which are he is both incredibly lazy and incredibly stupid. You know, like thank God for that, because who knows what he might have been able to do if he had been able to focus on anything for longer than 5 seconds. Yeah, I mean, America is not headed at this point anywhere good. Like, you know, 20% of America remains in this extremely bizarre and dangerous cult, and there doesn't seem to be any way to reach them with reality. So who knows what might happen.
And that, I mean, there was talk when Biden first took office about, you know, talking to these people and bringing them on board and, you know, having the rational conversations, but that hasn't panned out. You can't have rational conversations with irrational people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as I say, it is very much like a cult in the sense that it's just sort of developed an attitude that all information coming from outside the cult is extremely suspect and can be disregarded because, you know, it's a group of outsiders who are trying to deceive and eventually destroy you. Like they really do believe that.
But they're not outsiders, John. Marjorie Taylor is an insider, and she's comparing wearing of masks to the wearing of a star in Nazi Germany.
Well, here I'm saying like we're the outsiders. Typical.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? We're the dangerous people who you know are going to imprison and eventually execute Marjorie. So you can see why she's concerned about people like us.
I actually think it's like we're at a stage now where, you know, a mob tried to kill the vice president of the United States, and I know that even the vice president's brother is going to vote for the mob not to be really investigated.
that's exactly right. I mean, I never would have believed it possible, but they are absolutely terrified of their voting base. And, you know, if they want to try to overthrow the government and kill some of the Republicans there in the process, the Republican elected officials are like, well, that's understandable. Like I've done some bad things and I probably deserve it. So it's just, it's awful and it's hilarious, but it's also terrifying.
Yeah. Martin, can I ask one question, John, before we move off that topic, though? There are over 214 bills, I believe, working their way through various states that are effectively crackdowns on people, LGBT, particularly aimed at the trans community. Is the judiciary strong enough to support the rights for people in those communities? Because, you know... I hate to say it, but we've seen it. We've seen those rights being eroded in Poland and in Hungary and now in Belarus and all of these places. And if it happens in the US, it is very worrying. Like it's over 200 bills anyway. I know. And they're targeting specifically those communities. I mean, telling people to report parents for children who are trans just seems to me extraordinary. Given this 2021.
It is bizarre and it is scary. And I'm sorry to say, like, if you're looking to the judiciary to protect people, don't count on them. Like there may be some isolated instances, maybe more than isolated instances of some of these laws being struck down, especially ones that are incredibly egregious, but, you know, just is just so obviously unconstitutional and terrible on their face. But the Republicans are very, focused on wielding power via the courts, and they did an incredible job during the Trump administration of getting their people in there, including people who are just like absolutely bonkers and completely obviously unqualified, you know, rated as completely unqualified, but they're in there sitting on the bench for the rest of their lives. So if there's going to be anybody who is going to push back on this, it's not going to come from judges.
You don't sound terribly optimistic, John, about the future of America. Are you really pessimistic about the future of it?
You know, I mean, America is in some ways a very young country that still has the capacity to surprise you in positive directions. Like the standard course that empires take when they collapse is like, it's not foreordained for us. And, you know, America has a lot of great stuff. We have Disney World and Disneyland. I just feel that no one knows what the answer to our problems is. You know what I mean? Like you can't.
Is there an age split in this, John? Are younger people just generally more liberal and older people are generally more conservative? I mean, is there hope for the future?
Yes, I would say I think you are exactly correct about that. Like, if there is hope for America's future, it is that like America's young people are, to me, extremely impressive in their like almost total rejection of the standard tools of right-wing politics, of just like basic bigotry, of, you know, just hate for everybody's xenophobia. Like, if they really, to a degree that, like, when I talk to people who are, you know, say in their late teens or early 20s, even later on in their 20s, like, they're just a different generation. And when they get to power, I think it'll be much harder for the right to run things the way that they have for so long. And, you know, I'm sure people have probably seen like the voting split, like people over 65, you know, are just much more right wing than younger people. And so as they quietly drop off the face of the earth,
there's a cohort there who think socialism isn't a dirty word.
That's exactly right. Like the Cold War for them might as well have happened a million years ago.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even mean anything. Like, to be called a socialist, they're like, I don't even.
Yeah,
we have the same thing here to a degree, John, in that people who were born free of the troubles in Northern Ireland, to them, the recent past is just the same as the ancient past.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have that bearing or that lived memory. And it does make a difference. And we're seeing that it makes a big difference and it causes a swing in political direction. Is there hope that there are? Is there anybody in America that's coming from? Is there any shining light coming through? Or are you just sitting eagerly and waiting for the next one?
You mean, are there any individual leaders? Any
leaders? Yeah.
You know, I would look to like the climate change movement. I think that there are a lot of impressive young people involved in that. I think that you are going to see a continuing wave of young people running for political office. Like, that's already happening to some degree. I mean, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, she now she's actually, you know, not part of the young folk anymore. I think she's now 30 years old. But it really is happening.
It's ancient.
Yeah, exactly. like just mere hours away from death. But that is. I think that she was a sign of something that is what you really need to have cultural change, which is somebody like her with like her level of talent and her level of like energy and charisma. Like, in the past, she would have, she might have moved to Hollywood to be a movie director or an actress, or she might have been in a band or something like this, but she was part of a generation of people who were like, you know, it actually is worth it to run for fairly low level political office. Like, that's something that, you know, people that I know think is a good and worthy use of your time. And that is true for a lot of young people, where they think that that's a worthy thing to do with their lives. And so I think you will see that more and more. And it's the one place where there really is very clear hope. And so let's
I'm conscious of the old Clinton adage that we get thrown down our throats here all the time by our Minister for Finance. It's the economy, stupid. And you know, a lot of this is predicated on growth, and there is still, you know, a fundamental wealth gap. I mean, it's so funny. Ireland has a few years ago we discussed the fact that the US had I think it's nearly 7 years ago now, it was the first time in the history in the US history where the generation were worse off than their parents were at that age between 25 and 35. And Ireland, the ESRI, who one of our economic think tanks, came out with the same report saying, oh, look, it's happening here now, as if it was a surprise that this wealth gap was occurring. And we're also seeing a spike in inflation since the economy has reopened in the US. And, you know, is that just pent up demand? Is that, but we've also seen on the right people saying, well, that's just because the stimulus is too much and you're too generous giving people $300 and you need to give them less because they're all work shy. Is that economic argument going to be the one outside of the idealism? And I know, and you're talking to two pure idealists here, me and Martin, wanting a left-leaning socialist-led Ireland is what we want. But is the economic argument going to be the one that wins today in the US? That kind of, it's the economy, stupid again.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's a direct connection between the ever-increasing income gap in the United States and the liberalism of the younger generation, because they've seen that it's by no means foreordained that they're going to be better off than their parents. And in fact, they feel like really caught in a vise and think that their lives are going to be worse. And they are absolutely correct about that. That's one of the reasons why they've just like stopped listening to all the scare tactics of the right, because they've lived their lives getting worse and their prospects getting worse. And so they're willing to actually think over things anew. And I would say actually the inflation issue is a really significant sign of that. I think it's kind of amazing that inflation hasn't been higher, given that we shut down big aspects of the economy for the pandemic. And so I don't think anybody should actually worry about inflation. And in fact, moderate inflation, you know, fairly low level inflation is good for the economy overall. It's good for regular people.
And it helps us all shrink the debt that these idiots keep telling us we need austerity to pay it. Like, no, thank you.
That's right. I mean, we joke, but actually that's traditionally over millennia, you know, that's sort of like how governments have dealt with debt. There's just, as long as you have moderate inflation, that's fine. And the value of the government's debt and crucially, like the value of debtors in general in the society falls. And so it's a real loss in wealth for the creditors. And so that's why they're obsessed with inflation and like would like to strangle it if they could. But it's really not, it's not bad for other people as long as it doesn't get out of hand. And there's no reason to think that it will. So that actually to me is all good stuff, and is one of the key ways to slowly shrink the wealth gap over time.
And Biden has spoken about taxing the rich more, and he has spoken about trickle-down economics not working. What is he actually doing anything other than just mouthing words on this?
You know, I would say the answer actually is yes. You know, he is no great shakes, but I saw someone describe him in a way that I thought was like right on the money, which is they said that, you know, the thing about Joe Biden is that he's not like a sophisticated political thinker who has an ideology of his own. Like, his ideology is whatever sort of the median person in the Democratic Party thinks at any time in history. And that, you know, he's been in politics since whenever, like 1972. And you can see that there's been a real leftward shift, particularly in thinking about economics within the actual voters and members of the Democratic Party. Like, they don't care about deficits anymore. They want huge amounts of spending. They're fine with deficits. They don't care. And so for Biden seems to be okay with that, too. I mean, he just, you know, sort of has been talking about his budget recently, and they foresee, you know, $1 trillion deficits for the next decade. And, you know, from my perspective, that's totally fine. Like, there's no danger in that, and that's a positive way to get the economic potential of the country, you know, actually doing something rather than sitting idle. So
actually, he's read modern monetary theory, or someone close to him has read modern monetary theory and how it works, because we have ourselves here in our Department of Finance telling us that the next budget will have to be an austerity budget. It's just insane. It's insane.
Yeah, no, that you see that, like, that demonstrates that as much as like it's easy to always think that everything is getting worse everywhere, but like that demonstrates that things are actually getting better in the United States, and hopefully this will become a demonstration that other countries will see it and be like, oh, this really does work, and that people pushing austerity there will not be able to say, look to the United States, and you know they agree with us that we've got to really clamp down on any spending on like things like schools and food for children. We've got to get rid of that. Can't afford it. So hopefully this will come to pass in the United States, and that it will really affect the thinking elsewhere in the world.
It
too.
Will, because if the deficit, because we're stuck with this mindset that at some stage the EU is going to re-implement the debt to GDP ratio, which will mean Ireland has to play ball again. That's not going to actually happen, because if they do, Spain, Italy, Portugal, France itself actually will almost collapse overnight, because they can't do it. We've just come out of a global pandemic, but in Ireland we're going, yeah, but we're in 2008, this is what happened, and there's a fallacy here. But one huge glaring concern, and it's probably unfair of me to ask you this, because you don't realize that 50% of our tax take in terms of corporation taxes come from four or five of your companies, John. And
I do know that. And
yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a situation where it's very difficult for me to know, like, you know, if I lived there, like what I would think should happen, because it is possible in the, you know, given the international tax code, which allows companies to, you know, put little offices around the world and claim that, you know, it's like, well, sure, we're Facebook and we have 12 employees in Ireland and they are generating 2/3 of our profit, which is like, really well done, you 12 people. Good job. Like the international tax code makes that possible for these international corporations. And of course, like you can understand why the government of Ireland was like, you know, let's pave the way for these companies to do it, because, you know, it is true that they are taking tax revenue from other countries that really should be getting it, but you know it's hard to argue, like, when you're a small country.
Well, the argument they'll say, there's two arguments to this, and here's the fundamental one they use all the time, is that Ireland has no natural resources. We didn't have oil or diamonds or gold, and this was actually Artonis to put this in the newspaper recently, that we didn't have any of these things. So, and I always argue, so if you imagine, you know, when you're plumbing, you have your pipes, John. In Ireland, we had this company called Wavin Pipes that provided all the pipes that were building all these things back when me and Martin were young boys. And I always said Ireland had the best Wavin pipes in the world for passing your money through. And we charged a facility charge, you know? And so we didn't really tax you. We charged you a facilitation thing as it passed on through. And we have an industry grown up around that. But like, we've spoken to the Global Alliance for Tax Justice. We've spoken to them on this podcast several times. And the fact that they've been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize should worry the Irish government right now, because the world's eyes are on it. The EU's eyes are on it. And now Joe Biden is pretty unequivocal of how he wants this to go. You know, the taxes get paid where the output is actually done. So where the work is done, or where the thing is done, no more transfer pricing, no more double Irish, as it was called, or no more double Irish with a Dutch sandwich, as we have, no more trading intellectual property rights. I mean, I don't know if you saw, but recently Monster Energy, that can of mad fizzy drink stuff, I think I'm right in saying, Martin, put 1.7 billion through Ireland and didn't pay 1 cent on it. Was that the... He's on mute. But I think it was 1.7 billion, John, and didn't pay 1 cent. So how, you know, okay, how do we deal with it as people of the left? We understand that it actually means for every time we do this, it means probably less nurses, say, in a hospital in Nairobi, for example. We understand that, and that's not sustainable. But as we turn the tap off, we need to also turn it off slowly while we replace it with supplementary taxes and other forms of income. And when we look at the US, I know Joe Biden has made it clear that he seems to want to play ball in terms of a more joined up thinking into how these giant corporations, which dwarf the Irish economy themselves, how they get to operate.
Yeah, that's right. And it's I can understand why Ireland would want to turn the tap off slowly. Like, it is a situation where if you've built your entire economy on international tax fraud, like, it's very difficult to stop that.
That's not unfair. Like, I mean, like, I think the statistic is that there's 8 countries that account for 85% of global tax avoidance, and we use that avoidance loosely. And Ireland is one of the top. It's simple as that, you know?
Yeah. I can understand why people would be concerned by this. And so we'll see what happens. And in the long run, it'll be good for everybody. In the short term, it may be kind of rocky for some countries, including you guys, for sure.
Yeah. So I recall a couple of years ago when we first spoke, you talked about if Trump gets reelected, you'll want to come and sleep on this sofa bed here. I think myself and Martin would be run out of town if we're done for this. So, John, we'll see you in New York shortly, the way we're going.
Well, you know, you're always welcome. That's absolutely true. You know, if you need to flee because you're on the front page of every newspaper or leading the nightly news, or this is who did this to us.
Yeah. Hopefully,
we found those responsible, and it's these two guys and their podcast.
John, thanks so much for coming on, having this chat with us. It's always lovely to chat to you from the US of A. And you're right, and go strength to strength. And we'll put the link up to that piece that Tony was talking about. But thank you for coming on, having this chat with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It is always great to talk to you guys. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, John. Listen, folks, we'll be back in your feed tomorrow. We have a live podcast, and Don Foster, the journalist and writer from the UK, will join us to talk about Dominic Cummings and every shot he fired at Boris Johnson and the UK government. And the fact that actually, John, it's good that you're here, because it really proves the whole Trump line of I could shoot a man on Fifth Avenue and they'd still vote for me, because the things that Boris Johnson has been accused of, and yet he's still flying high in the polls. It just bewilders me, and it's stunning. We will talk to you all very, very soon, folks. Mind yourselves.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now.